The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Comparing Airports. While Raleigh-Durham International Airport continues to improve its service and connectivity, it falls short in a few operational metrics. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline. RDU growing, but transit limited. New research compares the Triangle's airport to others around the United States. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge and Craig Douglas. By many accounts, Raleigh-Durham International Airport is booming. In 2017 alone, its runways have hosted a slew of flights bound for new destinations from Austin, Texas to New Orleans. A year ago, the airport's second transatlantic flight, this time to Paris, took off from the 10,000-foot runway. As a result, the airport recently topped a national list of mid-sized airports when it comes to connectivity. But when it comes to operational efficiency, RDU trails both Piedmont Triad International in Greensboro and Charlotte Douglas International. In American City Business Journal's First Airport Power Rankings, which draw from statistics from the U.S. Department of Transportation and analysis provided by faculty at Wake Forest University School of Business, RDU operated at a 91% efficiency rate in 2015. Both GSO and CLT operated at a 100% efficiency rate, according to the report. The findings are quantitative and subjective. Spotlighting both where the industry is headed and which airports are leading the charge. While RDU consistently ranks highly in national reports about connectivity, the Power Rankings report card gives the airport a C. In a statement, RDU spokeswoman Christy Van Auken said it was experiencing unprecedented growth in passenger demand and new flight options. She noted RDU offers the lowest average fare in North Carolina and is home to 10 commercial air carriers offering 47 nonstop destinations. RDU is making critical investments in people and facilities, she said. Every airport is unique. Each community has its own unique imprint and capital investment horizon. RDU is embarking on our Vision 2040 Master Plan, investing more than $2 billion in infrastructure to serve our growing region, after decades of extremely low operating costs compared to other medium hub airports. RDU is ramping up our human resources to prepare for upcoming projects. As for the best run airport in the country, ACBJ's research points to Norman Y. Mineta International Airport in San Jose. The city-owned airport ranks among the best of its peers in virtually every financial and operating category measured by ACBJ, particularly when it came to productivity among its relatively lean workforce. And it doesn't hurt that the San Jose airport has convenience to the city's downtown area and a multitude of transportation options to and from the airport. Transportation in particular is where the report finds RDU lacking. It notes that RDU, unlike airports in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., has limited transit options. In Atlanta, a train can take you where you want to go, while RDU just offers rideshare, taxi, and bus service. The new Wake County Transit Plan will ramp up bus service to RDU, but will not include rail service. Even so, Joe Malazzo, executive director of the Regional Transportation Alliance Business Coalition, says leaders he talks to all have positive things to say about the airport's accessibility. He points out that three major highways access its campus. National rankings sometimes don't take into account airports serving dispersed populations, as RDU sits in the middle of Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. The distance to the major convention center included in the data, for example, doesn't take into account the multiple expo sites across the triangle, including the nearby Durham Convention Center. And while urban travelers might not find the transit connectivity they're used to, seeing at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International, RDU's job isn't first to serve them, Malazzo says. RDU's job is to service this growing metro area, so its location is perfectly situated, he says. It's not the Raleigh International Airport. San Jose's airport shot to the top of the ratings by increasing revenue and driving down costs. Between 2010 and 2015, the San Jose airport expanded its revenue by 26%, its non-flight related revenue by a whopping 40%, and its passenger counts by 22%. And it did that while tightening its belt. Over that same span, its total headcount and payroll costs fell about a third, while total debt was slashed by 6%. Over the same time frame, RDU's total operating revenue increased 23% and non-flight related revenue by 27%, according to ACBJ statistics. Boarding passengers between 2010 and 2015 at RDU increased from 4.6 million to 5.5 million, according to RDU, but total operating expenses rose by 22%, according to ACBJ's report. ACBJ statistics show its headcount grew 7% and its employee compensation and benefits by 17%, while total debt dropped by 11%. More expenses could be on the horizon as RDU embarks on its aggressive Vision 2040 plan that includes a new 10,000-foot runway. RDU Airport Authority CEO Mike Landguth calls critical for adding flights and keeping the airport's transatlantic flights. Some cost estimates put that chunk of the project alone at $350 million. While the budget circulating in the North Carolina General Assembly could help, as it puts nearly $53 million in state dollars in the airport's coffer, the overall plan calls for gate additions and a new ground transportation center, all with bills that could mean increased expenses in the next few years. Overall, airports across the nation vary in the report, sometimes to the extreme. New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport generated more than $1 billion in revenue in 2015, roughly 10 times what RDU booked that same year. Likewise, San Francisco International Airport's $111 million budget for repairs and maintenance was greater than the total revenue booked by roughly half of the airports included in ACBJ's analysis, RDU included. According to ACBJ research, RDU had revenue per employee of $376,041. By comparison, Charlotte's airport had $495,432. Nashville, Tennessee had $400,537. And Austin, Texas had $337,940. How airports compare. So how does one decipher whether an airport is operating at a greater level of efficiency compared to its peers? According to Jeffrey Kam, the Inmar Presidential Chair of Business Analytics at Wake Forest School of Business, the answer boils down to identifying a consistent set of inputs and outputs that all subject airports share. From there, it's about accepting that no two organizations are ever exactly alike and that outliers and exceptions will always sway the rankings. There's always the potential for inconsistencies, said Kam, who compiled an efficiency scoring system that was applied to ACBJ's rankings. To determine which airports were getting the most bang for the buck, Kam used a slate of inputs, operating expenses, total employees, and outputs, passenger enplanements, total aeronautical revenue, total non-aeronautical revenue, that were consistent among all operations analyzed. To account for significant size disparities, he then divided his findings into two buckets, airports with more than $100 million in revenue and those with less. The results, says Kam's former student and longtime aeronautics industry consultant Doug Goldberg, certainly warrant some footnotes, but the results mirror what he has seen in the field. The airports seeing the most growth and profitability are the ones investing in modernized spaces packed with retail and restaurants that can handle greater volumes of passenger traffic than their larger and, in many cases, outdated peers. By routing all these people through, it drives a lot of that non-aeronautical revenue, and that is what's supporting a lot of these airports, Goldberg says. Expansion played a primary role in ACBJ's power rankings, particularly as it pertained to passenger traffic and profitability. It's no surprise the two are closely correlated, particularly among airports that have invested heavily in non-flight-related revenue drivers such as restaurants, parking options, and hotels. Those are features addressed in RDU's own plans. The board recently approved a $73.6 million operating expense budget that includes $4.8 million to revamp its parking system. In April, RDU kicked off a plan to repair its own aging parking decks. And as the 10-year leases end at Terminal 2 retailers over the next year, RDU Airport Authority has released plans they hope invigorate the airport. For new restaurant options, including Whiskey River, which comes with an electronic bull ride, to new retailers, including the debut of TripAdvisor's first brick-and-mortar store, airport officials say they're trying to accommodate the traffic that's coming, but more expenses lie ahead. Just June 6, staff proposed a plan to pay for the site revamp, a proposal that would add on nearly $700 million in debt over the next two decades. RDU CEO Bill Sandifer said the plan is to pay for the site plan while at the same time keeping the airport's cost per enplanement in line with the competition. When taking into account both operational expenses and costs associated with RDU's in-progress Vision 2040 site plan, RDU's costs over the next several years could total $2.7 billion, according to the latest projection presented to the board. And that plan only includes funds for critical projects like the runway. No allowances are made for increased capacity, an investment the airport would need to make in the next 5 to 7 years if we continue to grow at the rate we're at now, Sandifer said. The bulk of the $2.7 billion at $905.3 million is estimated to go toward those critical airfield improvements, with terminals accounting for $724.3 million. To pay for it, the airport expects to take on about $659.3 million in new debt, a sum that accounts for just 24% of the projected costs, while existing funds and entitlements will account for a large portion of the remainder. The airport alone is responsible for 58%, or nearly $1.6 billion of the total expense projections. Net revenues, parking, increasing rates, and charges, that's where the rest of that money is coming from, says RDU CFO Donna Silver. Landing fees, for example, are projected to go from $4.12 in 2018 to $4.20 in 2020. Everything is about balance at the end of the day, RDU's Landguth told the board when presenting the plan. Farad Ali, chairman of the RDU Airport Authority, says the airport will find a way to add the additional capacity. When doing planning, you plan conservatively, he says, pointing out that numbers presented don't include bonuses such as the state funds included in the most recent budget proposal. Nor does it account for any increases the feds may allow when it comes to passenger facility charges, a federally regulated $4.50 fee that, in RDU's case, is already committed to paying off debt related to Terminal 2. Landguth, alongside other airport officials, have been campaigning unsuccessfully to raise that cap to $8.50. Sandifer pointed out that private funds, too, could factor into the situation moving forward. And when it comes to general aviation improvements, RDU is counting on private companies coming in to invest in hangars and infrastructure for their own air operations. Additionally, other grant opportunities could emerge. Revenue numbers could increase. But that doesn't necessarily mean they'll go toward discretionary projects, Landguth has said. Ali says all the investment will be worth it as the airport drives economic development in the Triangle. We are watching Raleigh grow tremendously. We see the transformation of Durham and other surrounding areas, he said. It's important that we build a world-class airport to meet the demands of our citizenry. Need for capital. Building a world-class airport requires cash. Dallas Love Field is a case in point. The airport led its peers in the ACBJ rankings when it came to growth in passenger boardings and growth in non-aeronautical revenue, but certainly paid for the numbers. It ranked 8th in the category of operating income growth by roughly doubling its bottom line between 2010 and 2015. Despite the capital-intensive business of running an airport, airport profits are booming across the country, the data show. In 2015, the nation's airports generated $7.03 billion in operating income, a 42% increase from 2010's total. During that same five-year span, operating margins improved to 35% of total revenue versus 31% in 2010. RDU officials say the investments the airport makes today will benefit the region for years to come. The airport also has a few other lures to reel in passengers, including price. Recent numbers from the U.S. Department of Transportation show it offers, on average, the lowest fares of any major airport in North Carolina. The fare difference between Piedmont Triad and RDU could motivate Triad travelers who don't mind the travel, who don't mind the drive, and who would not incur additional parking costs at RDU to make the trip, predicts NC State University economist Mike Walden. But the biggest differentiator could be RDU's aggressive destination list. This year alone has seen flight announcements for nonstop service in Austin, Texas, San Francisco, New Orleans, Las Vegas, and Nashville. Recently, the airport topped a connectivity list by Massachusetts Institute of Technology, analyzing medium-sized airports. It's done very well versus its peer airports, and that speaks to the health of the economy and the fact that airlines want to fly to Raleigh, says William Swellbar, research engineer at the MIT International Center for Aviation. He says his team first started putting its list together 5 years ago. The industry was really going through a difficult time, he recalls, of the Great Recession. Lots of flights were being cut, particularly in the smaller markets, and we felt it was really important to say that, yes, you might have lost your flights, but where's your connectivity, your ability to access markets of all sizes on a one-stop basis? His team updated the report in April, lifting RDU from third to first place in connectivity. RDU, he points out, has two transatlantic flights, a rare get for an airport of its size. Swellbar says any additions in connectivity are good long-term and that passengers are often able to look past operational issues in order to get where they need to go. Even if it takes longer to park or buy that pre-flight coffee, it's the destination list that gets passengers to the airport, he says. He calls RDU's connectivity network vital. It underscores the economic health of the triangle, he says. If I'm a business that is looking to relocate, I want to have the best air service I can. What you have in Raleigh is extremely good service that gets you access to virtually all points domestically and an increasing number of connectivity internationally. Which is why the funding choices RDU makes in the coming decades matter. Sandifer told the board, to stay competitive to expanding airlines, it must keep its costs per employment low, he said. While the airport is doing very, very good in terms of affordability today, as we start to implement the master plan, those numbers start to go up, he said. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The first headline, Bank Honors Durham's Bell. The board of directors of Durham-based M&F Bank on June 6 honored outgoing Durham Mayor Bill Bell with its Founders Award, given to individuals or entities that embody the founding principles of the more than 100-year-old institution, including being a mentor and role model in the community. Bell has been Durham's mayor for 16 years, ranking him as the longest-serving mayor in the city's history. He will not be seeking re-election for a ninth term in the November elections. In his presentation of the award, M&F Bank Corp Chairman James Stewart described Bell, who also serves in the bank's Durham City Advisory Board, as an outstanding ambassador for the bank and for the greater Durham area. We are happy to have this opportunity to demonstrate our appreciation, Stewart said. Durham has grown rapidly in Bell's time as mayor. He has seen downtown blossom, especially around Durham Bulls Athletic Park, and has looked to strengthen connections between citizens and the police force. Jefferson letter on display. Thomas Jefferson was known for being a prolific writer, and an 1816 letter signed by him after he was president will be on display in the North Carolina Capitol beginning June 22. Nathaniel Macon, a U.S. Senator from North Carolina, had written Jefferson for advice on sculptors for a George Washington statue. Jefferson said only Italian sculptor Antonio Canova should be selected. North Carolina hired Canova, whose statue was destroyed when the first Capitol burned in 1831. By the way, Jefferson asked that his letter and recommendation be kept out of the newspapers. Sorry about that, Thomas. Sports is more than fun and games. Elizabeth Lindsay spends much of her life immersed in sports and plans to be at Game 6 of the NBA Finals. But don't expect Lindsay to be out of her seat screaming over a LeBron James dunk or a Steph Curry three-pointer. Lindsay, based in Raleigh, is managing partner of the marketing division for Wasserman, a global agency with deep ties to the sports and entertainment industry and roughly 50 employees in Raleigh. During games, she watches closely to see how products are displayed, how fans react, and how the games and interactions play out on social media on her tablet. To me, the score and who wins and who loses is irrelevant, she says. I work with all these teams and I love all my children equally. Lindsay's group has been involved with the NBA for years, leading the American Express ties to the league, representing players, including three on the Golden State Warriors, and helping the team sell stadium naming rights. For example, Wasserman was involved in helping the Warriors evaluate the value of naming rights for their new arena, which opens in 2019. Terms of that deal were not disclosed, but estimates have put the 20-year deal at far beyond $200 million. A major project for Lindsay and her team now is evaluating the value of patches on NBA jerseys. The league plans to allow this next season. There is a value in and of itself, but what we worked hard to counsel our teams on is that asset in context of others, she says. In other words, how can the patch and association with an NBA team be part of a broader experience that appeals to fans? So, Lindsay's team at Wasserman helps an NBA team evaluate the value of the patch and what else it could offer to a corporate partner. Lindsay's team has members in more exotic places, London, for example, but Lindsay loves doing work with a global scope while based in Raleigh. She says recruiting talent to come here is not a problem. They want to do world-class work, but don't have to be in New York or London to do it, she says. Along the way, they can watch a ton of sports, but with a different view. This new list stings. Fortune Magazine's 2017 Fortune 500 list is out, and the Triangle's dearth of major headquarters was telling. While 12 North Carolina companies made the list, just one Triangle firm was among them. Quintiles IMS ranked number 390 after ranking 447th last year, but that comes with a significant asterisk as Quintiles merged with Connecticut-based IMS Health Holdings in October, and the shots are now being called from Connecticut. Ranking in the top 1,000 were Martin Marietta Materials of Raleigh, 607, Red Hat of Raleigh, 920, Ply Gem Holdings of Cary, 961, and Alliance One International of Morrisville, 963. Charlotte's Bank of America Corporation is North Carolina's highest-ranking company on this year's list at number 26. See you in 50 years. North Hills opened its time capsule from 1967 on June 8, pulling out items from 50 years ago at the old site of the Cardinal Theater, and into the ground to be stored for another 50 years when items from today. Biz is happy to report that one of those is a copy of the Triangle Business Journal dated May 12. See you on June 8, 2067. Hot spot for Raleigh. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance keeps a close watch on developments in the center of the city, and one area that is exploding is the area around Moore Square. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance says 19 storefront businesses have opened or been announced this year in the area, and food and beverage sales in the district have jumped 19% since 2013. Bill King, DRA's Senior Director of Economic Development and Planning, says it's a pretty diverse mix of businesses. You sort of feel like you're in a big city when you're walking those blocks and you see business after business after business. And now we turn to the On Retail and Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, $100 million project rises in Chapel Hill. Developers of the proposed Caraway Village mixed-use development project on the north side of Chapel Hill on Eubanks Road say construction crews will soon be going vertical on the first phase of construction with 400 new apartment units and accompanying street-level retail. The entire site of 53 acres has been cleared, and we're moving at full speed now, says Adam Golden, Vice President of Development at Northwood Raven. The development, previously known as The Edge, received site plan approval in 2015. In October, it was approved for a rare economic development incentive award valued at nearly $1.3 million that will cover about 30% of the cost of road improvements needed for all of its projected new residential and commercial traffic. The project, with a total value of more than $100 million, could build up to 935,000 square feet of new multifamily, retail, and commercial building space, with as many as 23 vertically integrated low and mid-rise buildings. The project's first phase, which is slated to open by third quarter 2018, will have 400 multifamily units and 8,400 square feet of retail space. The second phase could have up to 25 acres of new commercial development with a mix of retail, office, and hotel space. Golden says negotiations are underway with potential retail tenants that could anchor the Caraway Village project's second phase, but would not disclose which retail tenants are in the mix. Both Harris Teeter and Food Lion have grocery store locations nearby, and Golden did not rule out that a grocery store could be included at Caraway Village. Raleigh Investor acquires another property downtown. The real estate holding company owned by Raleigh entrepreneur Michael Olander Jr. has acquired its fourth office building in the heart of Raleigh's downtown district with intentions to open it back up for expanding retail and office tenants. Olander's MDO Holdings Company bought the former NC State Bar building at 208 Fayetteville Street from an Apex investor who has been holding the property since 2012. MDO Holdings paid $3.75 million for the three-story building, according to county records. Doug Worf, chief marketing officer at MDO Holdings and its O2 Fitness subsidiary, says the vacant building has close to 4,000 square feet of retail space facing Salisbury Street that will be available for lease, plus another 25,000 square feet of office space in the three-story property. New downtown Raleigh townhouses signal more to come from New York developer. A grouping of new high-end townhouses at the corner of West and Lenore Streets in downtown Raleigh is starting to take shape as the New York development firm backing the project, Lambert Development, begins to get more comfortable with the Triangle's residential real estate markets. Records show Lambert has assembled land for at least seven residential and multifamily projects in the Triangle, including the Brandon condo building in downtown Durham and proposed condos in downtown Raleigh and near Cameron Village. I'm based out of California and New York, but in the real estate business, you go where the projects are, says developer Henry Lambert, founder and principal of the firm. West and Lenore will be Lambert's first test of downtown Raleigh's residential market. Six of the 12 units in the first phase, priced between $469,000 and $578,000, have already pre-sold. Durham denies Public Store on Guess Road. The draw of bringing the first Publix-anchored grocery center to Durham was not enough to convince Durham City Council that plans for a new store at Guess and Lotta Roads were in the best interest of the neighborhood surrounding it. The City Council, in a discussion that went past midnight June 5, voted 6-1 to deny a zoning map change for the nearly 30-acre North River Village project. The property is currently zoned for suburban residential development, but any commercial or mixed-use development on the lot would need additional city approvals. And finally, in a section called He Said It, when we embarked upon the process of identifying a partner who would allow us to accomplish several objectives, we could not have written a better script. And that's from Van Isley, co-founder and CEO of Professional Builder Supply, which has been acquired by Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Corporation, led by Jim Goodman, by the Jim Goodman family. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed, but Isley and two other executives maintain an equity stake in the company that ranked at number 18 among TBJ's Fast 50 companies in 2016. And now we turn to On Tech and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Privatizing Air Traffic Control Concerns Small Airport Leaders. Calling the current air traffic control system ancient, broken, antiquated, and horrible, President Donald Trump announced his support for its privatization June 5. Instead of just falling under Federal Aviation Administration oversight, air traffic control would be managed by a private, nonprofit entity. The overseeing entity would be funded through user fees, charges associated with landing and takeoff. That's instead of excise taxes on tickets and fuel. But smaller airports across the state worry the new fee system would put a larger burden on small operators. Bob Hutz, airport director of Sanford's Raleigh Executive Jetport, says the current system may not be perfect, but it is the safest in the world. In this case, nothing has been shown to me that privatizing ATC will be better or an improvement over what we have, he says, adding that Congress should simply fund the FAA on a more consistent basis to allow for new technologies. I would prefer a system based primarily on safety and not one driven by a dollar or partisan politics, Hute says. User fees are a big concern with the proposal, notes Dan Danley, executive director of the Burlington-Alamance Airport Authority. They would impact everyone in the system, whether flying with a large airline, small airline, charter, or general aviation. That would be likened to having to pay a toll each time you hopped in your car to run an errand, he explains. Again, there not being a finished product, will general aviation be included or be exempt from paying user fees? Phil Lanier, director of Johnston County Regional Airport, says, I do support efforts aimed at making the air traffic control system safer for the future, such as the FAA's next-gen modernization efforts, but remain concerned about privatization and how additional fees could affect general aviation, he says. His job, update IT operations for state government. For Eric Boyette, his new role as North Carolina's Secretary of the Department of Information Technology is about partnerships. Boyette hopes his experience running the IT operations of one of the state's largest agencies gives him an advantage. He has two major priorities, improving cybersecurity and improving procurement procedures when it comes to technologies. We want to make sure our cybersecurity staff is trained, Boyette says. Part of that is setting a cybersecurity community to share information, but the training will include all state personnel, he says. The cybersecurity industry is not just about one slot in the agency, he explains. It's about the entire agency. It's important to ensure all state officials know not to click on malicious files and links. As for procurement, Boyette is a former department head who has seen how divided the state is when it comes to its vendor contracts. While the Department of Administration manages the bulk of the state's procurements, it doesn't manage its IT. Boyette hopes to streamline the system. How do we combine contracts where we have multiple contracts with the same vendor, he explains. The other thing I want to look at is our process. How do we help make our procurement process easier? How do we help our agencies understand the process? Six Forks could get six lanes in Raleigh. After more than a year of discussions, the city of Raleigh is pushing a plan forward that would widen the Six Forks Road corridor from four lanes to six. The 2.3-mile stretch from Lynn Road to the Beltline has a crash rate nearly three times higher than the state average. Revamping the road has been a major priority of the Midtown Raleigh Alliance. whose board includes area stakeholders such as North Hills developer John Kane. That is why Tara Robbins, MRA executive director, was celebrating Raleigh's decision to move forward with the plan June 6. There was a unanimous decision to move this to the next step, she says. The city considered two options: improve the four-lane road or widen it to 6 lanes. But impact studies for the four-lane plan didn't show enough of a difference. The corridor sees between 28,000 and 29,000 vehicles per day already. The $44.5 million six-lane option, according to city documents, requires acquiring more than 11 acres of right-of-way. The four-lane option would have required just under 6 acres and cost $37.7 million. Relief, woo, coming at Cary intersection. For the past 9 years, officials at the town of Cary have been talking about what to do with one of its most congested intersections. Finally, the intersection at Cary Parkway and High House Road is about to get improvements, says Tom Ellis, senior engineer at the town's Transportation and Facilities Department. We're getting close to construction, he says, of the $3.9 million project, which could start as early as October. We are working to get some utility work, some temporary streetlights, so you may notice activity before then. Data from 2011 show 23,000 vehicles travel along Cary Parkway and 24,000 on High House Road in the vicinity of the intersection. The project will increase the number of lanes approaching the intersection from 3 to 5 lanes for 3 of the approaches and from 3 to 4 for the remainder. Construction is expected to be complete in fall 2018. Triangle Tech firm raises cash to hire. Armed with $1.7 million, a Mooresville technology firm is planning to more than double its headcount. Field to Base, which has 15 employees in the Triangle, expects to hire an additional 20 to 25 people in the calendar year, primarily in sales and marketing, says Ed White, company chairman. And the equity raise disclosed in the securities filing will fuel the growth of the company, which develops software to automate field service, such as mobile forms. 6 investors participated in the round, which is capped at $2.2 million. White says Field to Base, which began in 2002, is all about mobility. Now everybody's got a mobile strategy, he says. Its technology, as its name implies, provides software for companies with workers in the field. It's used by enterprises looking to perform a variety of tasks, from changing out streetlights to completing on-site inspections, he says. The majority of its business was in the construction space until the recession hit and the construction world fell off a cliff, he says. We were fortunate. We were able to stay in business, he says. But treading through the downturn required a major strategy pivot. Fortunately, customers were receptive, allowing Field to Base to diversify, expanding its offerings into utilities and healthcare customers. Field to Base is already expanding, signing on for more space at its current building. It will have a total of 6,000 square feet with options on another 5,000. The company doesn't disclose its revenue, but White says it has been profitable for the past 2 years and expects to double revenue in 2017. We're under $5 million in total revenue, but we're growing pretty rapidly right now, he says. And now we turn to the On Life Sciences page, written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline: Novan pivots, cuts to save dollars. Cash continues to be a concern for Mooresville-based Novan, which has shuffled its leadership and slashed its workforce by 20%. Novan announced June 5 that CEO Nate Stasko would shift to president and chief scientific officer of the company, and the staff would be cut to be disciplined with regard to cash utilization. Kelly Martin is now interim CEO, and Robert Ingram, the chairman of the board of directors, will serve as executive chairman and devote additional time and effort to Novan. Earlier this year, Novan received mixed phase 3 trial results for SB204, a treatment for acne, and the stock sank more than 75%. Though Stasko called the mixed results a setback for all the other programs and diseases that we have the ability to treat, he said the company remains optimistic on SB204. That optimism, which includes a planned pre-submission meeting with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the third quarter, depends on cash. Novan says it can fund operations through at least the end of this year, but will need additional capital moving forward. The company had cash and equivalents of $30.1 million as of March 31. Analyst Donald Ellis of JMP Securities says the cuts are what they needed to do to conserve cash and fund some of the other programs. Novan employed roughly 60 people as of April. Novan's other programs in development have the potential to provide non-dilutive funding, like the licensing agreement, valued at up to $43 million based on the exchange rate at the time of its announcement. Novan recently struck with Sato Pharmaceutical for the development of SB204 in Japan. Moving SB204 toward commercialization in the U.S. could involve an additional Phase 3 trial, which would be timely and costly. In a previous interview, Sasco put Phase 2 costs in the $2 million to $10 million range and Phase 3 costs in the $9 million to $40 million range across the company's pipeline. Global Specimen Solutions adds to team. Raleigh's Global Specimen Solutions is expanding its leadership team ahead of a number of product launches, says founder and CEO Amelia Wall Warner. The company has hired Gabriel Ballant, owner of laboratory information management system-focused company BGA Soft, as senior vice president of software development. Two products, Global Code and SnapTrack, have been on the market since 2015 and are close to release, Warner says. Ballant will be leading maintenance and development when it comes to a suite of informatics products for the pharmaceutical industry, according to Warner. Carrie's Relias Learning makes another acquisition. On the heels of its first acquisition in analytics, that of Morrisville's Care Management Technologies, Carrie-based online training company Relias Learning continues to expand with the purchase of Boise, Idaho-based White Cloud Analytics. The acquisition of White Cloud marks Relias' second acquisition in analytics, Relias CEO Jim Triandaflu says. We are absolutely looking to do more, he says, noting that there may be additional acquisitions this year. Relias began talks with White Cloud roughly a year ago, according to Triandaflu. He says the company was particularly attractive in terms of its clients providing hard dollar benefits from White Cloud's platform. Triandaflu says Relias has transitioned White Cloud's less than 100-person workforce to the company and that it will keep the outpost in Boise. Relias's headcount is currently well over 600, he says. In April, Relias announced its acquisition of Morrisville's CMT, shortly after that of Boston-based Advanced Practice Strategies, which was aimed at expanding into pre-hire assessments. At the time, Triandaflu said the company would look to build out its existing three products, training, analytics, and assessments, before delving into more. He further said that the process would involve future acquisitions and added, we think in analytics. We're going to also buy a good number of companies, and CMT is our foundation for that. Law firm ramps up service to HQ community members. HQ Community and Hutchison PLLC have linked up in a new partnership, which will see Hutchison provide pro bono legal services to select HQ community member companies in Raleigh, Greensboro, and Charlotte. Our firm has traditionally had a pretty high commitment to incubators and accelerators in the area, says Anna Therrington, a partner at Hutchison. She says Hutchison has previously offered office hours and presentations for HQ community member companies and now will provide more tangible work product for participants. Typical Hutchison clients are high-growth technology and life sciences companies, a profile that coincides nicely with HQ Community's tenant base. And finally, in a section called She Said It, we saw the BMS Investment and Collaboration as really a confirmation that our technology was useful in the pharmaceutical and biotech industries. And we really want to expand from this initial collaboration to many more collaborations. Walter is going to lead the expansion and build and bring us additional drug development collaborations using our platform, and will oversee the company's commercial strategy. And that quote is from Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman, CEO of GeneCentric, on adding Walter Capone as the company's chief business officer following a new collaboration with Bristol Myers Squibb and a $6.1 million equity investment by the New York-based pharmaceutical giant. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where first we read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline: Are wages thwarting our economic optimism? It's remarkable how things change in 10 years. Well, almost. Just days ago, Pew Research Center's Global Attitudes and Trends Division came out with a detailed report on how citizens across the world feel about their own country's economy. The study notes the Dutch, Swedes, Germans, and the Indians feel the most positive about their respective country's economy among the top 32 nations surveyed. As for the U.S., nearly 6 out of 10 Americans believe the economic situation is good, especially after registering more than 80 straight months of job growth and with the unemployment rate only at 4.6%. In spring 2009, as Pew notes, the jobless rate was 9.3% and only 17% of Americans thought the economy was good. The current mood of Americans currently is higher than the pre-recession levels in 2007. But within these encouraging numbers lie some statistics that cloud the optimistic narrative. For example, a median of just 41% believe that a child in their country today will grow up to be better off financially than their parents. The French, Japanese, and the Greeks generally lead this pessimistic brigade. Of particular concern to every American should be how fast optimism is growing in other advanced nations compared to the U.S. The Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Poland, Israel, Australia, and Canada all registered a robust turnaround in economic confidence in the past 7 years. If you're looking for a reason as to why the American optimism is not growing as fast as other advanced economies, don't look any further than wage growth. Income levels are simply not keeping up with growth and profits. In North Carolina, for example, in the past 5 years, weekly wages of workers in sectors such as manufacturing, financial services, and other service providers have increased anywhere from 3.4% to 8.5%. That's total from 2012 to third quarter 2016. So while people have jobs, their income growth looks muted. While profits and the stock market are registering record gains, the dollar is not flowing downstream as fast as one would think. Hence, there is a slight lack of exuberance from a typical American worker. Still, nearly 60% of Americans feeling good about their economy is definitely on the right side of the equation. You don't want to be Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, or Mexico. At least 70% or more of the citizens in those countries believe their economy is headed in the wrong direction. Our problems look far easier to solve when we put our issues in context when comparing the economies of other countries. And our other Viewpoint column is written by Chris Budnick, who is the executive director of Healing Transitions, formerly the Healing Place of Wake County, a peer-run recovery program in Raleigh, serving over 250 men and women each day at a cost of less than $40 per day. The headline: Stop Act, a good start, but more needed. In the aftermath of last year's turbulent elections, our elected officials in North Carolina have been busy setting their agenda for the coming year. And while North Carolinians remain divided on many issues, there is one thing I believe, we all can agree on. We must work together to end the opioid epidemic taking the lives of people across our state every day. According to North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein, more people in North Carolina die of an accidental drug overdose than any other cause of accidental death. For many, something as benign as a prescription painkiller can unexpectedly lead to a drug addiction, but reducing the availability of opioid prescriptions could help reverse the cycle. This tragic reality has pushed Stein and his team to make tackling this epidemic one of their top priorities while in office. That's why a bipartisan group of lawmakers met with local law enforcement officials earlier this month to announce the STOP Act, legislation aimed at improving prescription guidelines for opioid drugs and providing treating for people addicted to opioids. There is a glimmer of hope despite the grim outlook. We are witnessing unprecedented attention on the prevention, treatment, and recovery from opioid use disorders, and we are experiencing greater collaboration between law enforcement, addiction professionals, and the recovery community. We are seeing more and more people seeking and maintaining their recovery, and individuals who were previously lost in the system are finding support they never had before. This bill is a positive sign that our state's leaders are taking this crisis seriously, but if all we think about is fixing the opioid epidemic, we miss an opportunity to fix the existing barriers that got us here in the first place. There are three things we can do to avoid this mistake. 1. Shift our assumptions. We need to find a way to move beyond our assumptions of those who deserve our care and those who don't. There is a subtle but powerful narrative in our conversations about addiction that implies that someone who is an accidental addict or medical addict, perhaps your neighbor who started taking OxyContin after a sports injury, is more deserving of treatment, recovery support services, and second chances than someone whose addiction is considered their own fault. 2. Serve all in need. In a crisis, we naturally want to fix the most urgent things first. But to see real gains in this fight, we must make sure the continuum of care serves everyone impacted by a substance use disorder, not just those impacted by the opiate epidemic. Opiate overdose deaths account for 63% of all drug overdose deaths. When we include all drug overdose deaths, 52,404 in 2015, the death rate in the U.S. now surpasses annual deaths from car crashes, gun-related homicides, and the peak year of deaths from AIDS. We need a recovery-oriented continuum of care to help all individuals with a substance use disorder initiate and maintain recovery. 3. Share our common story. To quote a colleague, which one-size-fits-all approach should we be using? Rather than focusing on the divisions that have historically existed between those responding to this problem, we must focus on improving treatment engagement, treatment retention, outcomes, and quality of life for all people impacted by a substance use disorder. This issue is personal to me, not just because I lead the team at Healing Transitions, a peer-run recovery program in Raleigh, but because of my own experience with substance use. As a young man, I found myself on the other side of addiction. I was regularly using drugs and alcohol by the time I was 12 years old. And it wasn't until I entered a treatment program several years later that I started the process of recovery. Recovery has allowed me to become a valued and contributing member of my family and community. There are many people who gave me a chance. People like Bernie, who hired me to work in his restaurant right after treatment. I try to find ways every day to pay it forward, just like Bernie did for me. Several months ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who runs a substance use treatment center in Michigan, and he told me something that's stuck with me ever since that conversation. He said, "We want to meet people where they're at, but we don't want to leave people where they're at." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Barbara Brothers, Executive Director of Corporate and Business Solutions at Wake Tech. Barbara Brothers has been described as an innovative problem solver with a drive for helping those around her find success, and that's what she is tasked with in her new role as Executive Director of Corporate and Business Solutions at Wake Technical Community College. That description of Brothers from her new boss, Anthony Kaysen, Wake Tech's Vice President of Workforce Continuing Education, will be evident in her approach to the position, Brothers hopes. Brothers will be responsible for Wake Tech's Small Business Center, the Wake Tech Wells Fargo Center for Entrepreneurship, the Advanced Manufacturing Center, and apprenticeship training and customized training and professional development programs at the college. This position was a great blend of my career experience and offered an opportunity to stay in the education sector while joining a national leader in the community college network, Brothers says. Also compelling was the opportunity to relocate closer to family. Wake Tech's enrollment sits at about 71,000 students annually. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? Wake Tech's corporate and business solutions team is a valuable resource for all industry sectors and businesses, no matter how large or small. We help businesses find solutions to their challenges through workforce development. What are some of your major goals for your position? To increase Wake Tech's corporate training footprint by growing business development staff who will reach out to the business community to help them solve the challenges they face. Biggest pet peeve? When I encounter an attitude that the glass is half empty. Biggest worry? Keeping pace with the economic changes to ensure world-class training and support to the business and industry we serve in Wake County. Education? Bachelor's degree in mathematics from Vanderbilt University. Last book you've read? The National Parks, America's Best Idea by Dayton Duncan and Ken Burns. And in our final minute, we'll read a little bit of Economist, North Carolina growth expected to be modest in 2017, an article from our Around the State section written by Hillary Burns. John Connaughton, UNC Charlotte economist, says there is more slow growth on the horizon for North Carolina, with the state's economy increasing by 2.4% in 2017 compared to a 1.7% in 2016. Connaughton says the state is in the eighth year of positive economic growth and is entering the second longest economic expansion on record, although it doesn't really feel like that, the economist adds. Growth has been slow, under the average 3% real GDP growth rate that was consistent in the U.S. after World War II. Connaughton brought his quarterly economic update to the Ritz-Carlton on June 5 in partnership with the Charlotte Business Journal. Connaughton has delivered a quarterly presentation on North Carolina's economy since 1981. And we will go ahead and stop there. As we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal, be sure to listen the next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.